So we're really privileged to have Dr. Hanrahan here in this session to speak from the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research at the University of Pennsylvania in the School of Nursing. Dr. Hanrahan is the principal investigator on the study that she'll be reporting on today, along with Phyllis Solomon. And I want to do, this looks like a fantastic study, so we'll leave some time for discussion.
So hello, everyone. Can you hear me all right? Okay. So I'm going to be describing a study that was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Nurse Inquiry Program. We did it in 18 months, which was a very big feat. Phyllis Solomon and Matthew Herford were co-PI and co-investigators. I have no disclosures to report. So most of us know about the grave needs of people with chronic illness within the healthcare system as it stands now. Their needs are not being met. Their great disability, and the chronic illness itself is affecting 133 million people, which is a third of our society. 78% of the total U.S. healthcare spending goes to treat these chronic illnesses. And treat them is a word that we could use in a very conservative way if we wanted to say it was good treatment. Now, people with serious mental illness, which is the population I've been studying now for a number of years, as well as working with them clinically, we've come to note that this population lives 25 years less than the general population because of treatable healthcare problems such as hypertension, any cardiovascular disease, diabetes, et cetera. And they are some of the highest need and highest cost population of the chronically ill. The study by Chronic from the Center for Healthcare Strategies in Washington, D.C., it's called The Faces of Medicaid 3. If you haven't been exposed to that particular report, I would encourage you to look at it because it is a real seminal report about what it is that, what's made up in the integration of medical and psychiatric need in this population. And they describe triads, meaning what are the top 10 physical and mental health diagnoses of the most costly 5% of Medicaid spending. And of those 10, 7 have psychiatric diagnoses as the number one in the dyad. So we're talking about 15 million people, and we annually, per person cost of these folks is between $43,000 and $80,000 a year. So despite this level of investment, the poor health of the SMI is just stunning. They die earlier, and they have 3.4 times rates of heart disease than the general population. 3.8 die from accidents. 5.0 times, meaning the general population compared with the general population, they die from respiratory ailments, pneumonia, influenza, and HIV rates are very high in this population, especially those with schizophrenia. So one of the things that I do in my work in research is I seek out innovative models that could make a difference with this population. And the Patient Affordable Care Act of 2010 has really skidded the path for this. One of my colleagues, Mary Naylor at the University of Pennsylvania, designed the transitional care model as an evidence-based practice and trialed this with the elderly and cognitively impaired older adults. It uses an advanced practice nurse to manage care of high-risk clients from hospital to home. So it's a very specific timed intervention. It's been studied over 20 years, and it shows significant improvements in outcomes and reduced costs for high-risk clients, particularly with chronic illness. So the research questions that we were looking for to answer is we wanted to translate this intervention from the elderly population to those with serious mental illness. And what I'm going to do today is really go more into the third question, which are what are the barriers and facilitators to implementing and sustaining this model in the SMI population? We've done multiple other ways to look at this, but this is particularly what I'm interested in because we are doing a follow-up study. So we used a pilot random control method. We had 40 subjects that we recruited from two units in a single general hospital in the city of Philadelphia, recruited our subjects between March and September, which tells you a bit about what the discharge rates are in those units. They're high census almost continuously. Control group received treatment as usual, case management provided by community mental health associations. Experimental group had 90 days of attention by a psychiatric nurse practitioner who is a nurse with a graduate degree in the specialty of psychiatric mental health. Who met with the patients prior to discharge, worked with a discharge planner, and then within 24 hours of leaving the hospital, the nurse met with the patient in their home environment, wherever that might be, or wherever the choice of their choice was, within 24 hours of discharge. She did home visits, ongoing phone calls. The client had access to her through texting and phoning 24/7. She accompanied them to medical and mental health appointments, contacted medical and mental health providers, medication management, and this lasted, as I said, 3 months. So eligibility is important in that we did select those that were seriously mentally ill just by the fact they were in the hospital, they met that criteria. More problematic for us was we initially set up this major medical illness as a criteria for eligibility, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. And I've already talked about this. So our outcomes that we measured were medical and psychiatric readmissions, emergency room use, links to community mental health providers. Our analysis, of course, was not using formal statistics because of the sample size, although we did do some chi-squares. And I'm just going to give you a summary of that right now. I'm not even hardly going to brush over it. First of all, the control group had lower medical and psychiatric readmission rates than the intervention group. Secondly, the control group had higher emergency room use than the intervention group. And thirdly, there was no difference between the two groups in their links to community. So at first blush, you would think, oh my, this didn't work. But what we decided was to explain this, that if you give a nurse to somebody who's not had any other choices when they're ill, what's going to happen is they're going to increase their utilization and probably utilize the services more appropriately than not. The other really cool indicator I thought was the emergency room use went down, 33% use by those in the experimental group versus the control group, which was well over 55-60%. So we could see some effect there that from the nurse in avoiding some of those services. I also like just to quickly mention that we did measures at baseline 6 months and 12 weeks. So if we were to do this again, we're going to measure out further because it's just too soon to measure an effect of this nature with this population. So here's the real meat of what we had and what we learned. We looked at patient barriers, and we found that relational conflicts limited coping skills and behavioral discontrol, engagement, and unmet basic needs were three factors that really stand out to explain the populations that needs that are specific to this population versus other populations. So why relational conflicts? In general, we all deal with stress, but the stress loads of this population are higher than most people due to stigma, poverty, living in high crime neighborhoods, unstable housing, and multiple unmet health needs. When a mental illness flares, stress responses can be exaggerated as stress thresholds are fragile and coping mechanisms that normally manage stress do not function sufficiently. Many participants we found living with siblings, spouses, parents, and significant others, or staff from shelters and residential care who were equally unable to cope with the stresses that were presented to them, and these alternatives often used substances or alcohol to cope. Shelters or supervised housing situations just bred contentious relationships because the staff are just not trained to deal with extreme behavioral responses. More important, they have little backup to avert crises. Who do they call when somebody is psychotic, is out of control with their paranoid delusion? Loss of housing, unfortunately, often leads to the use of hospitals or jails as the safety net. So this is how far that this behavioral discontrol can lead to extremes and also lead to readmissions. So, for example, one participant with schizophrenia was involuntarily admitted. This is the initial admission or index admission because he barricaded himself into his apartment and was accusing others of putting dead bodies in his room. He was aggressive with residential staff and refused help, believing a conspiracy existed to hurt him. He had a toe amputated, and this is because he had diabetes, because he was taking Zyprexa for an extended period of time and then went untreated. he had this amputated in January. We picked him up in March, and the sutures were still in his toe and were flaring into an infection. Another participant was hospitalized because of conflicts with her sister with whom she lived. When the relationship would flare and there was drug and alcohol use, she would present to a psychiatric crisis center with reports of suicidal and command auditory hallucinations to harm her sister. We believe that that was a pattern behavior, that she was speaking she was saying the right things to get out of the environment that was completely untenable for her, and so she was hospitalized. So hospitalization for a psychiatric condition can relieve hallucinations and lower stress by providing a reprieve from difficult life circumstances. However, a brief hospitalization cannot change living situations or improve the ability to cope with stress, nor stabilize relationships. Indeed, many patients leaving hospitals today remain acutely ill and in need of assistance to cope with everyday life circumstances. So that emotional valence I mentioned earlier on the relational conflicts, limited coping, and behavioral discontrol, this does not get treated in the hospital environment. And I dare say it doesn't get treated much in the outpatient environment either. I'm going to put engagement speak just a little bit about engagement. In the population with a serious mental illness, it is very, very difficult in many circumstances for them to engage in treatment or develop a therapeutic relationship. So we found that to be also a distinct difference. Unmet basic needs, we're talking about safe and consistent housing, food, physical hygiene, and comfort are lacking for many with SMI. Housing, for most participants in our study, 25 to 30% in both groups did not have stable housing. 52% changed housing during the study time period, and 20% were discharged from the hospital to the streets or shelters. Of the participants who were readmitted, unstable housing was the cause for greater than 50%. Several admitted that going to the hospital for them secured them 3 hots and a cot. Those were generally the people that were homeless. Unsafe neighborhoods, they are victims of crime. Nutrition, the average income is $711 per month. I challenge any of us to live on that amount of money. One study found that 28% of homeless people with previous psychiatric hospitalizations obtained some food from garbage cans, and 8% used garbage cans as a primary food source. hygiene is poor. There's high rates of influenza, infection as a major source of medical problems. Generally, the unmet need of this SMI population is very, very high and should be noted as barriers. So there are system barriers. Now, we all know the fragmented system, the fractured care environment, the episodic care versus long-term care or any substantial care coordination is a huge problem. Given that, one of the things that we focused on was that some of the issues that came up were medication. When they left the hospital, they're given 2 weeks of medication. They're prescribed 2 weeks. But yet they may not get an appointment with a psychiatrist for 6 weeks to 3 months. So what do? Well, they don't take their medication. What does that do? It ends up in them being back in the hospital. So this was a very popular or very active engagement for the nurse practitioner. And there were, I have several examples, but I can't get into them. The other system barriers, this communication barrier being easier in the medical sector than the mental health sector, has to do with the interpretation of HIPAA. HIPAA is used to prevent providers, family members, significant others to access individuals that are in hospitals. So we have 13 hospitals in our city, and our patients participants could have gone anywhere. We couldn't access them if they went in a hospital because we would be told at the door we can't say if that person is here or not. Now, the HIPAA laws actually do not, it's a misinterpretation of HIPAA laws. And let me just read this to you. No. So the HIPAA laws itself say providers can have access to patients, and but what happens is in various states there are other overlays of privacy that get involved, and the administrator of the hospitals have to set up policies, and everybody has different policies. What ends up is bad care and inappropriate use of HIPAA. The other issue is clinical data is not accessible. In our city, physical data and mental health data are kept in separate buckets, and ne'er do they come together, unless you're a researcher and you work really hard to get that Medicaid data to be integrated. And it's a really big problem because you need that data to provide appropriate and cost-effective care. So who is best served by transitional care models? We found several important factors. We initially put a major medical illness as the primary eligibility factor, but we ended up deciding that really it's need for immediate medical attention that really should drive the eligibility. And it also doesn't even have to be medical. The need for health care. The need for medical attention could be the patient that we had that went out of the hospital and went to the oncologist and had received a diagnosis of colon cancer, had an immediate acute anxiety attack. The NP was with her, dealt with that. The oncologist was so happy. This is pretty typical because this kind of behaviors don't fit well in their environments. And overall, it worked really well because the nurse was then able to follow up with the patient and be really clear about what needed to be done and what actually happened. So the nurse practitioner becomes the ambassador for this individual across these hugely siloed, non-communicating systems. And the third thing is you have the right provider at the right time for the right patient. We've been trying to do this for a long time. I can't say over the long time what that would mean of the long term, but for the 90 days transitional care time, this nurse practitioner is highly efficient in meeting the immediacies of those unmet needs. And we are recommending in the changed, the translation or the adoption of the transitional care model that we have a team of a nurse practitioner, a professional social worker, and a peer support. So these are the major highlights of our study. Thank you.